without dating that way. Well, you know, out in the southwest here, we have so many ruins. It begins to look as though our total population in here were Pueblo Indians, were they not?
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Not the roving kind. They were.
No, the Navajo and the Apache didn't get into the area that we know of. At least their earliest remains are right south of us in northern New Mexico here. I think 1540 is the earliest date we have. We presume they were here a good 100 years before that. How much before that, we don't know.
Yeah. Of 1540 was the coming of the first Spanish.
But most of our Pueblos are gone, except the Hopi, the Zuni, and the San Juan, I mean the Rio Grande peoples.
Yeah.
Most of those are gone by 1300, or soon thereafter.
John, in doing this dig now, you've come across a lot of burials and so on, and I expect you've studied those. Do you find a lot of disease?
Yes.
And what particularly?
Two. First, for the whole overall skeleton, malnutrition.
They didn't have enough to eat.
Regardless of their agricultural potentiality and everything else, the fact they raised corn, beans, squash, supplemented it with things like sunflower seeds, which they may not have, well, sown as we would today, mm-hmm. but at least they kept them growing around the site in large numbers and so on, garnished everything with the seeds. I guess you get a little protein out of that. And then there's meat.
Yes.
And we find plenty of meat scraps in there, small animal as well as deer, but they still seem to be suffering from malnutrition. The winters must have been just too harsh and long.
Mm-hmm. You wouldn't. Was the biggest population in the 9th century?
It is, as far as we can ascertain today, at least north of the San Juan.
North of the San Juan region.
Yeah, I can't speak to, say, the people down in the Chaco. I don't know whether that would be their largest. What we found down there seems to be a little later than 9th century. But here, yes, in Mesa Verde and the new Weathero Mesa over there, which has just recently been explored, very definitely. 9th century seems to be the greatest growth.
Mm-hmm. Now, for the whole area, I know you go about these things systematically. What do you have in mind as far as surveying or sites to dig, or just what are you planning here in the next 5 years, let's say?
Well, as far as a survey is concerned, I'm limiting myself and our people here at Fort Lewis for the simple reason that Dr. Lister...
Bob Lister.
Dr. Yeah. Bob Lister, yes.
Yeah. University of Colorado.
Well-known figure here in the Southwest, here at the University of Colorado for a long time. Graduated the same alma mater as myself. Mm-hmm. Has been conducting a survey over Southwest Colorado for so many years now that for me to just try to duplicate the effort, well, just a waste of money.
Sure.
I can have access to his notes, and it's much better to work cooperation between the schools this way.
I would certainly agree
with
that.
My aim now is to pick sites to excavate that will yield answers to pressing problems. Mm-hmm. Questions that we all have here in the Southwest, we want answered. See if I can pick a site that will answer at least some of them.
You wouldn't want to estimate the population of, let's say, how many people do you think were living out there in and around Ridge's Basin, out around Mr. Bodo's ranch?
It would be difficult to estimate. There are numerous farmsteads, but each are small little family groups. I suppose the entire population probably wasn't more than 100 and some people at one time.
I see.
Small, but scattered.
I see.
Little farmers. By the way, Bob, our second year, 1968, out there, yielded a concentration of remains. It didn't look, there was no evidence there of winter habitation. It looked like a spring, summer, early fall habitation. In other words, a farming mm-hmm. gathering. Probably the people from the ridges.
What makes you say that, John?
Well, because the normal sites are up on in that little area, are up on the ridges, a half mile to three quarters of a mile to sometimes a mile and a half apart.
I see.
Scattered, little homesteads. Sometimes maybe two or three families live together. They're probably all related.
Yes.
And these little related groups living scattered all out. And then it looks like come summer, they all got down closer to the water, closer to their arable lands. And again, though, the same pattern prevails. There are these little units scattered out, but now they're closer together.
Mm-hmm.
They are simply small units all scattered around, like a little clan here and a little clan there and a little clan there.
So
each having their own way, but all using these communal lands.
Yeah. And then had a whole series of small ruins rather than one large
that's
central
right,
ruin.
That's right. So sometimes I'm wondering if I'm correct in speaking of a site when I dig one of these ruins.
I see.
I have a hunch the whole thing is a site. By the way, the Reverend Root, you know, has done a couple years out there before
yes.
I came. And it was in the same kind of material, more of a scattered out homestead affair.
Well, now out in the west end of the San Juan Basin, up in Montezuma County, north of Cortez, out in that area, was that same thing hold true out there? You know, there's quite some large mound sites out there. And of course, we have the National Monument up there on the state line.
Yeah.
And that was a little concentration, but that looked like to me like all agricultural area there,
mm-hmm.
too. Now, did the same thing hold true over there?
At that time
yeah.
or later?
Well, during the period that they lived in that area.
Well, now, that area is occupied for a much greater length of time.
Than over here?
Oh, yes.
You mean Goodman
they
Point
stayed.
And the area around
they stayed almost to the bitter end there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Which was close to 13. And Goodman Point, probably most of the terminal occupation there is 1,200 or right thereafter.
Yeah.
And then they got for the cliff sides, you know, like we find at Mesa Verde and so on. But,
well, that there's some couple of hundred years later than the other abandonments.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
And do you think it was the ancestors of the present Navajos and Apaches that were pressing in on them that made them go into the caves?
These theories have been put forth by some of my colleagues, yes. Until somebody, however, shows that Navajo and Apache
mm-hmm.
were in this area, let's say it's very hypothetical.
It is, because there seems to be about 200 years gap.
That's right.
Or 100 years or something
and
like
now
that.
We could bring in this great drought business
yes.
that they get from tree rings, and one has to ask the question there about winter water, which puts on the tree rings, summer rains, which bring in the corn. And they don't always coincide, you know. You can have a poor winter year and record little tiny tree rings and still grow good corn in the summer because you get more rainfall.
Yeah.
So sometimes those are not accurate.
The total growth isn't.
But the big thing that I question here, Bob, is the fact that different areas, different little valleys, different little sections of the Southwest here were abandoned at different times, not all in one mass. So we have 1,300 abandonments. We have 1,150 down in the Chaco. Mm-hmm. We have 900 here in the part of the Animas Valley and maybe 800 in the northern part, and so on. The Governador was abandoned maybe 1025. How do you put all this with a drought?
Mm-hmm. Do the tree rings show other droughts as serious as the one that they claim was from 1276 to 1300, the period when Mesa Verde
I think we are constantly having alternate droughts and good years.
Yeah.
And No, I don't think we can answer this question right now. Did we have a drought great enough to drive people all out of Mesa Verde?
Right. And you can't answer that.
I can't answer it, no. There's always that question, and it's for anybody to see and everybody. I think the layman, when he walks to Mesa Verde and he sees these cliffside ruins, the first thing he thinks of is defense. Why else jeopardize little children on the edges of these cliffs and whatnot? If it weren't for some defensive reason. By the way, Dr. Arthur Roan from the University of Illinois,
I know him.
Excavated over in the Yellow Jacket area
yeah.
This summer. In fact, this is his third year on the
third
same
year
site.
Out here. Mm-hmm.
And although he had a very small crew, had to get volunteer help and everything this year, he tackled a problem that most of us don't have the time or resources to tackle. He got outside of the little things that you can see, you know, the buildings and so on. Mm-hmm. He started stripping the soil on and outside, and he found that this site was palisaded. Okay. Now, this is before, about a century before they went to the cliffs. Mm-hmm. This is about 1100.
And probably for defense.
What else would you palisade? Yeah, it's a beautiful countryside there, and there's no other good reason to do so. Right in the middle of what now is a bean field, a huge bean field. Yeah. Here is the palisade around the site.
Now,
several kivas and buildings and whatnot, all incorporated within this wooden palisade.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I know people are interested in, John, is there an antiquities law in Colorado? What are restrictions on digging? Are there any? I mean, outside of going on somebody's property that belongs to him.
The law simply reads that one does not excavate without permission, and permission is granted only to institutions recognized by the Bureau of Indian Affairs and by the Bureau of Interior.
The
Department of the Interior. Mm-hmm. Now, this would be state forests.
Yes.
And of course, to excavate there, we have to go through the state forest, the Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management. These kind of public lands, which takes a different kind of a permit, but still government lands.
Sure.
And these are excluded, and Indian lands, which also must, there you go to go through the BIAN and Department of Interior.
Even though the Indians might be very...
Tribal council has to agree first, and then you go on. But, you have to go through the tribal course first, naturally. It's their land.
One of the things that has always...
Now, one can dig on any private land at any time.
At any time it gets permission.
Providing the farmer wants them to, and so on. I have been trying my darndest to encourage the ranchers and the farmers hereabouts to protect these and for posterity and for an institution that can exploit them properly and publish them. And so on.
We've talked all around the subject of digging and the like. What do you find mostly in a dig? You might describe to us a little bit the things you find, how you... record it, and do you take pictures of it and the like? I'm looking at an actual, you're on the job.
We do two things, Art. Yes, we photograph it. We photograph every blessed thing, sometimes in triplicate and quadruplicate. I carry a number of cameras. I do my own photography, and it's just one of my adjuncts, and it's almost a necessary thing for an archaeologist to at least be a part-time photographer. Some of us get more interested and do more. All right, we take the photos, and we also make diagrams, scale diagrams, of as much as possible. Now, in our, you know, we have a course in the summer here, a field excavation course for the students. We pick a ruin and so on. And the students are taught here to do the diagrams, the drawings, and so on.
I see. And then... what about the artifacts that you find? Do you find your bowls intact, or some of them broken, or which way?
You're just lucky to find one intact. Most of them are broken.
And it's always other people that find them intact.
It's always other people. For us, it's usually a bunch of smashed ones, and it's a tedious job. And here my wife plays a big part. She helps me endless hours in this reconstruction. In fact, I shouldn't helps me. She does it.
Well, you put the
some town people, yes.
You also have, in that laboratory course that you teach, you have students putting them together in the wintertime, don't you? Some things, don't I see them in there on work tables?
Oh, you see them
doing?
Working, yes. But they have to learn to identify them by time period and by area and so on.
Well?
We can't have them just doing museum work.
Oh, no. Now, what do you find, for instance, pottery of the 9th century, let's say? What's identifiable about it? Color?
All right. pottery of the 9th century.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, it looks like pottery of the century and the 2 centuries and the 3 centuries before, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
It's roughly finished. It doesn't have that that smoothness to it that the later pottery does. Generally speaking, it doesn't have that whitish slipper exterior or interior on a bowl. It is crude. The designs look cruder in concept.
John, before we're quite through here, what do you intend to do next year?
Next summer? Next summer, I'm hoping to go back to the Areola region where we, north of Cortez, where we were working this summer, and finish out that site there.
I see.
There's a lot of important questions still to be asked and answered.
Now, you eventually write all of this up, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
You find, you keep and classify many artifacts?
Yes, that's, that's the tedious part of the job. That takes the winter.
You've accumulated in quite a little bit of it,
haven't you? We have accumulated quite a few, yes, we have.
How many would you say items, different items?
All I know is he's got paper sacks full of them all over the place.
We have, and they'll soon be in the museum on display. In fact, that's something we're working on now, is getting them displayed.
Well, thanks, John. You've told us a lot about what you're doing in this area, and I think the people of the basin be happy to know it and to deal with you anytime you're out and doing some of these things.
Assignment 6 has brought you San Juan Heritage, produced by this station in cooperation with the Center for Southwest Studies at Fort Lewis College here in Durango. Your host for this series, Dr. Robert Delaney, head of the Center of Southwest Studies, and Mr. Arthur Wyatt, former Colorado State Representative and longtime resident of the basin. Their guest for tonight's program was Dr. John Ives. The Bank of Durango wishes you and urges you to remember that credit cards were mostly for businessmen on expense accounts for air travel, eating out, hotels and motels, and renting cars. It used to be a sort of status thing for anyone to have a wallet full of credit cards. Well, that was before MasterCharge, the one all-purpose card that men, women, young and old, married or single, can use. This one card does everything all the others do and then some, because MasterCharge is like all the other credit cards put together. And MasterCharge, which is bought to Durango by the Bank of Durango, is the new all-purpose card that gives you credit privileges everywhere you see the MasterCharge emblem. Accounts have been opened for you automatically at thousands of stores, and many of them where you've never had credit before. In fact, until now, hundreds of these stores have probably carry MasterCharge cards, and 500,000 places of business honor them in the United States, Mexico, Europe, and the Far East. Why not apply for your credit card at any of the businesses that honor the MasterCharge or the Bank of Durango, the bank that brought it to Durango? San Juan Heritage has been brought to you tonight by the Bank of Durango. Be tuned in next month for the next in a series of San Juan Heritage programs. San Juan Heritage has been directed by Dan Wilson tonight, engineered by Jim Knispel, camera by Steve Gilkey. This is Dan Wilson speaking, and thanking you for joining us on San Juan Heritage. Made it by a shoelace. Oh, we could talk about this for eons, and I just set that off. We got to have him back. We just got started, as you guys know. Just barely got into it.